David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 353. I'm your host, Steve Raker, back from the beach, which is why there was an extra skip week between episodes here, and with you for another episode where we talk about anything Marvel. Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can stream and download new and archived episodes over on marvelnoise.com. We've got Facebook and Twitter pages where we announce new episodes, share image galleries, and take feedback. Marvel Noise is proudly part of the Deliberate Noise Network, where you can find other fine shows like Comic Book Noise and Indie Comic Book Noise, which is our sister show, where Kevin, Andrew, and I, and Phil, talk about the indie comic books that we're digging on. Item. As we feared but expected, the 2020 Baltimore Comic Con is switching to an online event. But if you're a ticket holder, your tickets will be good for the 2021 Baltimore Comic Con, which will be October 22nd through the 24th. In the meantime, check out BaltimoreComicCon.com or follow them on social media to get details on the online event this year. This episode, Kevin and Andrew will be on with me in a little while to talk about a Moon Knight arc from 15 years ago or so that was the sequel to the Moon Knight story we talked about a couple of episodes ago. But first, I want to talk to you about what I read over vacation, or some of what I read over vacation at least. Remember Uncanny X-Men number 137? Where the X-Men fought the Shi'ar Imperial Guard on the blue area of the moon there for the life of Jean Grey, the Phoenix, who didn't survive the experience. Or did she? I mean, both Jean Grey and the Phoenix Force have been back multiple times, but back then it was a big deal, really. Anyway, in that issue, emissaries of both the Skrull and Kree empires participated in the battle on the side of the Shi'ar. But they didn't like being on the same side, and are last seen in that issue attacking each other instead of fighting alongside each other. And the Kree-Skrull War was, of course, a classic storyline in The Avengers by Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, among others. The war ended when Rick Jones called forth a bunch of timely Atlas Golden Age heroes in the big finale, and Mar-Vell was involved and all, but tensions between the two races certainly linger. It's kind of now a cliche scenario with the lone soldier or soldiers who are still fighting the war that's ended, often because they've been cut off from communications and hasn't heard that the war ended or something. They're in an island or in the deep brush. But these two combatants have appeared multiple times since. But usually it gets reset back to that moment of them fighting each other on the moon. They've, interrupted Medusa and Black Bolt's wedding, they've been turned into avatars of their races and everything, but the important thing is that, they're still at it. So fast forward to 2019, and the five-issue Meet the Skrulls limited series, which was written by Robbie Thompson with art by Nico Hendrickson, with Marcos Martin covers. I thought this was just a bold ripoff of the Americans television show. I mean, we've had Skrulls in hiding before with the Skrull Kill Crew and that post-Secret Invasion Spider-Woman series where she's chasing down Skrulls that are in hiding and stuff. But this undercover Skrull cell masquerading as an American family ends up having big ramifications as the catalyst for this current Empire event. The dad in the family ends up being killed by their official Skrull contact, which leads to the incoming one-shot, which was a huge 80-page one-shot issue that was sort of like a Marvel .1 in a way. This ties the Masked Raider, Eternity Mask guy from the Marvel Comics 1000 and 1001s from the year before last, you know, the anniversary issues. And he's investigating a murder. And the investigation takes the reader throughout the Marvel Universe, which checks in on the current status quos of everyone. It's written and drawn by a variety of different creators. Oh, and the murder victim? It's the Kree from X-Men 137. And the Skrull doesn't fare well either. This issue also shows Hulkling from the Young Avengers as an emperor of a united Kree-Skrull empire on its way to Earth for unknown purposes. Now that leads into Road to Empire, the Kree-Skrull War. Here Robbie Thompson pens a one-shot that has the Skrull family from Meet the Skrulls going over their story, the Skrull and Kree histories, including the Kree-Skrull War and the Celestial Madonna story, which is what this whole Empire event really is a sequel to, or pays homage to. From there, the story goes to Empire Number Zero, Avengers, written by Al Ewing, with art by Pepe Larraz. This has the persecuted by the Kree plant people, the Kotati, and the swordsman, you know, their ambassador from Englehart's Celestial Madonna saga way back in the 70s. And the swordsman enlists the Avengers for aid to protect them on the blue area of the moon where they've been growing. They need to be protected from the coming Kree who want to exterminate them. So that's what the United Kree-Skrull Empires and the Armada on their way to Earth is about. The sister book there is Empire Number Zero Fantastic Four, written by regular series writer Dan Slott with art by R.B. Silva and Sean Isaki. The Fantastic Four are stranded in deep space and are rescued by a floating cosmic casino. There, the Fantastic Four discover two youth, one Kree and one Skrull, who have been modified, indoctrinated, and trained to kill each other in the casino's arena, where bets are placed, of course. The Fantastic Four bust the place up, escape, and take the Kree and Skrull kids with them, essentially adopting them. This moves into a one-shot Lords of Empire, Emperor Hulkling, written by Chip Zdarsky and Anthony Oliveira, with art by Manuel Garcia and Cam Smith. And it shows Hulkling wrestling with his heritage and his options as a united Kree-Skrull Empire comes looking to him as a figurehead emperor. You're really not going to have to do much, you know? Just save a lot of lives. And this all leads into Empire Number One. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Empire series itself, not really giving any spoilers beyond what you might see on the covers, and then touch upon a bunch of the tie-ins. But I've got to tell you here and now, folks, that this event is odd in that it's those lead-up issues that I just discussed that are the must-reads, as well as the Empire series itself. And I don't mean a must read, like if you like Marvel Comics, you must read these. I mean, if you want to experience what the Empire story is, these are the stories you've got to read. Once the series proper started, the other tie-ins and one-shots, and none of them really matter to the story itself. I thought Empire was going to be like the finishing touches on some seeming conspiracy to totally destroy Alan Heinberg's Young Avengers cast. I mean, except for Kate Bishop and Cassie Lang, a.k.a. Stature, who did exist as a character before that, what they've done to these characters is, well, it's a shame, because it was a popular group. Empire, the event, is written by Al Ewing and Dan Slott with art by Valerio Chidi. In the promotions and lead-up to this series, it looked as if Hulkling was going to be sort of shoehorned into some out-of-character villain role in service of the almighty crossover. Instead, I got served up the Green Swordsman, not one of my favorite characters, if I'm being totally honest. And this thing turns out to be an all-out war between a united Kree-Skrull Empire, led by figurehead Hulkling, or are they, and the plant species the Kotati, all of a sudden uber-powerful, with the Earth and its moon as the battleground. So whose side are the Avengers on? Whose side are the Fantastic Four on? The X-Men? How about Captain Marvel? She's got strong ties to the Kree. Are these United Kree-Skrull Empire really working from good intentions? Is Hulkling being duped? Is the Cosmic Messiah from Englehart's Celestial Madonna story a bad guy? And for reals, where are the Guardians of the Galaxy? It seemed like I've read 5 of the 6 issues that have come out of Empire so far, and they haven't been touched upon or mentioned. Just as a side, is that, like, do they not know what to do with the Guardians of the Galaxy, or what? I mean, some of these series have been entertaining, the last few in particular, but it's like, as a team, reflecting the movie cast, they don't seem to last for more than a couple of issues before they get totally broken up and sent on to side adventures, and it's so funny. Marvel has no idea what to do with the Guardians of the Galaxy. This seems like something that the Guardians would have had to be involved in. So, there have been 3 Lords of the Empire one-shots that accompany the Empire event. The first one was the Emperor Hulkling one, which was really a prelude to the event, and on my list of must-read if you're going to experience the event issues. The other two, not so much. Lords of the Empire Celestial Messiah is written by Alex Packnadel and art by Alex Linz, and it covers Kwai, the Celestial Messiah, wrestling with his identity via visions from his past, dealing with his origin, and actually, there's a pretty poignant scene where he confronts his mother Mantis, but this issue is still a pass. The other is Lords of Empire the Swordsman, also written by Alex Packnadel, with art by Thomas Natchlik. This juxtaposes the swordsman's relationship with his son as a human with his post-Kotati rebirth form's relationship with his celestial messiah son. It's a skip. I'd say read some Englehart Avengers instead. Now, regular series were affected by the event for a couple of issues here and there. The Fantastic Four, X-Men, and Captain Marvel, to be specific. In Fantastic Four 21 through 23, written by Dan Slott, with art by Paco Medina and Sean Ozaki, we get more of this backstory on the Kree-Skrull Gladiator Kids, who crash land with Franklin and Valeria on Earth. The Kree-Skrull kids start fighting each other, so Franklin and Valeria put out a call. Wolverine and Spider-Man show up, and then when a bunch of super-powered, Kotati-worshipping ninja priest types attack, who knew the Kotati had such fans on Earth? You guessed it, the Ghost Rider and the Gray Hulk show up too, so it's a reunion of the all-new Fantastic Four from the Walt Simonson run. Then, in X-Men 10 and 11, written by Jonathan Hickman, with art by Lionel Yu, in issue 10, the third retconned Summers brother, who I wish didn't exist, Vulcan, who was once the leader of the Shi'ar, visits the Kotati on the moon, and they mess with his mind. In issue 11, Magneto nearly single-handedly repels a Kotati attack on Krakoa. In Captain Marvel issues 18 to 21, written by Kelly Thompson with art by Corey Smith and Adriano Di Benedetto, after the events of Empire issue number 2, Carol has taken up the role of Emperor Hulkling's supreme accuser, wielding and possibly becoming corrupted by Ronan's battle hammer. She wrestles with performing her duties to the Empire as well as advancing her own personal agenda, when once she learns that she has an accused Kree sister, who she sets out to exonerate. Then she deputizes War Machine, Spider-Woman, and Hazmat as accusers with hammers, and it was like a Fear Itself flashback for a second with all these characters being redesigned with their hammers. The bottom line is, if you're already reading Fantastic Four, X-Men, and Captain Marvel, keep reading and enjoy these issues. But if you're invested in what's salient regarding the Empire event, I'm here to tell you you can skip them. There were three other Empire side series and another Empire one-shot. There was Empire Avengers, written by Jim Zub with art by Carlos Magno. Here, Dr. Nemesis from the X-Books, Luke Cage, and the Vision perform some horticultural surgery in Central Park. It's three issues long and also has Quicksilver, Mockingbird, and Wonder Man positioning themselves between the Kree and Kotati forces in Mexico, and Captain America, the Black Knight, and Brother Voodoo helping Kazar in the Savage Land against a Kotati-possessed Shanna. It results in a big status quo change for Kazar in the end. In my opinion, not for the better. The three-issue Empire Captain America series is written by Philip Kennedy Johnson with art by Ariel Olivetti, where Captain America assembles a new group of howlers to take on a Kotati priest who sends a Billy the Mountain-sized homunculus against them. The four-issue Empire X-Men is written by Jonathan Hickman with Teenie Howard, Jerry Dugan, Brian Percy, Leah Williams, Vita Alea, Ed Brisson, and Zeb Wells, with art by Matteo Bafangi, Louis Wernick, Andrea Bacardo, and Jorge Molina. These four issues have the Scarlet Witch trying to resurrect the dead Genosian mutants and makes mutant zombies instead, who the Kotati now encounter while they're setting up a beachhead on Genosha to strike at Wakanda. So it's alien plants versus mutant zombies. Angel, Penance, Magic, and Madrox go to help. Oh, and the Golden Girls, the horticulture, are on the scene too. But whose side are they on? In Empire Savage Avengers, which is fortunately a one-shot, that is written by Jerry Dugan with art by Greg Smallwood, we've got Conan and Venom versus the Kotati. Conan even drives a steamroller over a Kotati. Say it ain't so. All four of these Empire title tie-ins can be skipped. You heard it here first. There are Empire She-Hulk, Empire Fantastic Four, and Empire Avengers Aftermath books in the works. So the jury's still out on whether those will be pertinent. This whole event was unexpectedly pushed off the publishing rails with the onset of the whole COVID crisis and shutdowns and all that. And there were actually 13... other issues that were scheduled and originally solicited that are missing in action and never appeared. A three-issue Empire Spider-Man series, a three-issue Invasion of Wakanda series, a three-issue Squadron Supreme series, a three-issue Thor series, The Union, which I forget how many issues that was going to be, and an Empire Ghost Rider one-shot. But as I said, read the prelude tie-ins that launched the event, and then the event itself, but you can really skip a lot of these other tie-in issues, which seems to be the way that, even though these last few, or maybe even several events, have been enormous in scope, they've set things up that you really don't have to read the other fluff unless you're particularly interested in those characters or those creators, which is why I mention who does these books and who's in them. For your benefit. I read these things so you don't have to. All right, let me get the guys on. The moon is out, and I've got Kevin and Andrew on the line as promised. Right? You're on the line? As promised?
Present and accounted for.
And I'm out on a line.
All right.
Closing line.
We are waxing and waning about another Moon Knight arc. This time it's called God and Country. You see, when we looked at Moon Knight 25 from way back, the Munch-Sienkiewicz series from the 80s that had the Carlson Knowles Black Spectre villain for Moon Knight, Kevin pondered, well, did we ever see him again? And we did in this arc. So I made the guys read it while I was on vacation. So in this 2006 series, writer Charlie Houston portrays Moon Knight like as this ultra-violent, recovering from having like both knees shattered, addicted to painkillers, and having visions of Khonshu speaking to him, like presenting as his arch enemy Bushman with his face cut off.
Yeah, he's no skeleton bird man, I'll tell you that much.
It's funny, Steve, when you told me about this, Kevin and I had just been talking. I don't necessarily agree, but he said that the Audis were our least represented decade on Marvel Noise. So I was like, oh, so Kevin arranged with Steve so that we'd read some Double Zeros, and you said this, and I said, you know what, I'm going to start at issue one and get right... I did not make it. Spoiler alert. I read a few and then skipped up to 14.
The art's pretty.
Yes.
But Andrew, it reads so fast. And you still couldn't make it through.
It's a different Moon Knight, as Steve. It just has a grittiness that reads like almost silliness to me. It's so over the top, I feel. Yep. Like,
you know what I think of it as? You know when you watch HBO and that first episode is like a setting of the tone? It kind of reminds me of that type of storytelling.
More tone than substance. This is also the post-Civil War era of the Superhuman Registration Act, and that was Marvel status quo. So Houston has Moon Knight sit for a psych review to get his card. And he would most certainly fail this review, except that Khonshu pulled some mystical mumbo-jumbo on the doc. And that's when new writer Mike Benson takes over. And he continues to build on these elements with this God and Country arc in issues 14 through 19 in the first half of 2008. And it features Javier Salters with layouts and Mark Texeira art. Good old Tex. Moon Knight's just brutally serving up justice here. He's like scarring perpetrators and leaving little crescent the scars, like incisions on their foreheads and stuff.
That's almost Black Panther-esque.
Or like the Joker or something, for Pete's sake. Like, really, leaving the calling card.
Why do you mention the Joker? There's a scene later on that's like pre-New 52. And I'm like, does he preserve that? It's like the same thing.
And Moon Knight's constantly being egged on by this aggressive Khonshu as the faceless Bushman. And he's got his registration card, so it's all legit. It's crazy.
As long as he doesn't burn it like his Avengers card.
The cast of sidekicks, I'm not, like, they have the regular ones, but it's a unique twist. And having Khonshu be kind of like a jokester as well was a weird tonal shift. I guess it was meant to inject some kind of dark humor, but it really didn't work as it almost felt like they wanted it to be like a watered down Deadpool kind of thing. And I don't know, it just was a weird tonal, like, I would have thought focus on the vengeance, less on the corny one-liners.
Not just that, but it's like I almost think they were going for the Moon Knight needs someone to talk to, like Deathlok would talk to his pewter, which I loved that relationship, but I didn't like this. And I even like future iterations of the Khonshu Moon Knight going back and forth. You know, Khonshu wasn't so chit-chatty back in the Doug Munch stuff as he became. Here he's replaced his supporting cast. It's funny you would bring that up, Andrew, because it's like Spectre has driven away everyone. He's driven away Frenchie. He's driven away, you know, he doesn't even go down to Gina's anymore. You don't see Crowley until later on. Marlene is, she's been on the outs with him, but she keeps popping in, giving him like a little sliver of a chance for reconciliation. But his supporting cast has been broken down. All he's got left is this Bushman.
That seems like a very decompressed early 2000s thing to do. Like with Spider-Man too, they sort of pared the supporting cast down.
Well, they just want, Marlene is just basically wants booty calls and that's it. She doesn't want a relationship, she keeps saying. And Frenchie and him are on the outs, but they keep running this very after-school special about Frenchie learning to come to grips with coming out of the closet. And if it were, like, I have no problem with Frenchie being gay, but I thought it just read like, oh, now we're going to get a bit of a lecture on how, like, all the trouble they face. And it's not to belittle the trouble people face, but it just felt kind of ham-fisted for the oddies. Felt like that was, like, something that should have been in the 80s comics where they're like, yeah, gay people are human too, instead of this one where they're like, oh, now they're going to get beat up and everything. And I really like Frenchie.
Me too.
But he was done. He has the prosthetics in this one. So I was kind of hoping he would snap too and maybe get Mark out of his mess a little bit.
This is, like we said before, the post-Civil War era of Marvel. And with Moon Knight doing all of this violent vigilante behavior, Iron Man, who's, you know, totally the poster boy for enforcement of the Superhero Registration Act, he gets word of Moon Knight's seemingly sanctioned behavior and starts investigating. I mean, he is the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. and everything. They go and question the doc who did Moon Knight's intake for getting his registration card, and when they open up his door, it's just his feet swinging from the ceiling. He's hung himself.
It feels like this Moon Knight would have fit right in with Norman Osborn's Avengers team.
Yeah,
he could
yeah,
right. have been their, one Batman. Of their fill-in.
He could have been their Batman. And now, the reason we picked reading this arc, Carson Knowles, while all this is going on, he's the former Black Spectre and almost mayor of New York, who's just been released from prison since he's been incarcerated way back in the 80s from Moon Knight 25 that we covered two episodes ago on Marvel Noise 351. He sees the news stories about this ultra-violent Moon Knight at large, and things have been just as sucky for Knowles since he got out of prison as before his ascension, when he used Moon Knight and becoming the anti-Moon Knight as a catalyst for his almost rise to the top. And it's funny because he doesn't even know that Moon Knight is Mark Spector, and he was the Black Spector, and he was the anti-Moon Knight. He was the anti, you know, he was the Black Mark Spector, the Black Spector. You get it. You see what I'm trying to say.
New York City would never, in the Marvel comics, have an ex-criminal as their mayor. I mean, that would be unbelievable. You know?
So Knowles is ridiculed at work. He's called a loser, and he's teased for his, you know, carrying around a mace. His parole officer is crooked and wants bribes from him to keep his reports positive. And it's all too much for Knowles, who goes off the deep end and hocks his old sword out of a pawn shop closet and takes it to his parole officer and tells him what for with it and hacks him up.
I'm like, where did he get the money to redeem that pawn? I mean, that must have been sitting there for 20 years or something.
No one wanted it.
As we said, this iteration of Khonshu, he's really aggressive and hostile, and he keeps demanding his avatar, Moon Knight, to serve up dead bodies in his name. He's, like, repeatedly threatening Mark that he'll get another avatar if he has to, but you gotta keep being violent and keep serving me up bodies. Knowles happens upon Marlene at an armor museum exhibit, of all places, and once again, just like in issue 25, she falls for his trying-to-redeem-himself shtick.
All he needs is the love of a good woman, Steve.
And meanwhile, Knowles is killing his victims, and he's leaving a crescent mark on their heads so that his killings are attributed to Moon Knight's already violent behavior. So now people think he's gone really over the end, and Mark knows that it's Knowles, but Marlene won't believe him. Deja vu again from issue 25. Iron Man shows up with S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, and Iron Man doesn't believe him either. Although Moon Knight breaking a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent's arm when he put his hand on him probably didn't help matters much. Knowles also gets a break when one of his revenge victims has a cache of stolen Stark Tech S.H.I.E.L.D. weapons. One of them is a bomb that releases nanites into a crowd that the user can then mind control. Probably an app for that.
Boy, this is getting to be like Dark Avengers with nanites.
Right? Knowles decides that he's going to do that to the crowd in Times Square and force them all to love him, give him the love that he deserved that Moon Knight took away. First, though, he's going to get his dignity back by attacking Moon Knight.
Oh, I thought he was going to go on Larry King.
He really takes a beating to Moon Knight. I mean, it seems like this guy always has Moon Knight's number, right? He always gets the upper hand on him and gets him good. Moon Knight's left, like, bloody and beaten and everything. So he calls Crawley. Finally, we get one of the old cast. He calls not for information, as would have been in the past, but he calls him for painkillers. The very addiction that he has just recently fought so hard to kick. But instead of giving him painkillers, Crawley shows up and slaps him around a few times, and pretty hard, too, and gives him, like, a rallying speech. It's the one he needed to hear.
These guys only respond to pain. But, I mean, you're under, like, there is copious amounts of blood when he, this isn't, like, just shaking him or something. There's, like, blood flying and as he beats the stuffing out of him, and
just
but
as
you
feel...
say, it's just what you needed. You know, as we learned in 25, Moon Knight can't fight him unless he's been beat up first.
So. No, it's true.
In the finale-ish, Moon Knight gets his mojo back, and he confronts the Black Spectre on a Times Square rooftop, and they're fighting and everything, but Knowles, he is going to succeed in his plan. He releases the nanites and everything, and he's like, on top of the world, man. He's got his arms outstretched just like I do right here in front of my computer that I'm podcasting from. And Moon Knight simply pushes him off the rooftop, and he takes a several-story fall, and presumably to his death.
I thought the crowd would catch him.
I do like the storytelling they did with this one, because it's at this rally and they're projecting images of the heroes people like. So it's a full page spread with Moon Knight throwing him off and then the projected image larger of him throwing him off. And I was like, that's pretty cool. Like, I like that. And we all know Knowles loves, you know, landing on, he should have landed on a fence or some other spike. That's his normal move. But...
In the epilogue, Moon Knight then rejects this version of Khonshu as the statue is broken as it's taken out of his house. And Benson would stay on as the writer for the rest of the series, which ended with issue 30. And the remaining issues were arcs featuring Venom, Bullseye, and the Punisher. It was a dark series, guys. I mean, some good art, though, from Finch to all the Texiera, but I don't think Houston or Benson did Moon Knight any favors as far as developing his character or setting up a new status quo or providing any service to his supporting cast. Or, you know, the best thing they did maybe was bringing back the Midnight, Son of Midnight character that was supposed to have, you know, all cyborged out and died in that Sidekick's Revenge Amazing Spider-Man thing with Nova and Night Thrasher and all that back in the 80s or 90s.
We keep on coming back to things like that.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things. Like, Houston and Benson both were obviously fans of Moon Knight. But yeah. It seems like they just went back and Bushman's stories were told already. And they already had him come back 20 years later, like in the 90s series, and have a big, giant confrontation thing. Like, Bushman's done. He needs to be shelved. And this, you know, the Midnight Man, you know, whatever. I guess there'll always be some connection with that. But I guess it's just too tempting to just try to touch upon those, do your love letter to those issues. I mean, I loved issue 25, right? When we talked about it a couple of episodes ago. But I don't need to tell another story just for the sake. I mean, he didn't even tell a very original story. And in a lot of ways, it mimicked issue 25 rather than being something new.
Well, he even points it out. It's the same spot. Are we going to do the same thing again?
This is kind of outside the scope, but because I did read a bunch of this ahead of time, I wasn't, like, they have to kind of reset the table, but I really hate how they lock it into an era so much. Like, they give all the dates of when he was in the military and when he did this and when he did that. And I feel like they could have kept that sort of, and I know they have to, because look, no one's reading those comics from the 70s and 2007. So, but it just feels like it's anchoring it to a moment in time that it didn't need to be anchored to, because, you know, we have all these, a lot of the Moon Knight people were Moon Knight fans. Like, we all read some of those issues. It was a pretty well-regarded series. So I just thought that was a weird choice of resetting it. But they had some interesting bad guys. Like, in the beginning, the guy that can kind of read all the signals you give off and everything as the setup for putting him back in play.
Like, I thought that was profiler.
Yeah. But they just made, like I said, for me, when it's this, like, over the top, it's just silly. I mean, you can do that with maybe the Punisher and a few other characters, but I feel like if you're going to have him in the regular Marvel universe, it's hard to be like, Iron Man's like, oh yeah, that's cool. Maim as many of those dudes as you want. it doesn't, tonally, I don't know how you find that fit to have him interacting with the other heroes.
What kept me turning the pages, honestly, was to see Texiera's art and what he was going to do on the next page. I love Texas stuff.
Yes, I preferred it to the Finch that started it, because this was the era of, again, these are just my own peccadilloes. I don't like the effects applied to the image. You know, like the car crash, so they blur it and all.
This
is the height of, oh my God. Look, and I get it. Like, there's all these new tools to communicate, and you want to use them. I just feel now, years on, it feels like maybe they were overused at times. But I'm sure some people are like, no, give me more of that blurred images. It makes it seem alive.
So back when we covered issue 25, Kevin, I was saying they should have just left Carson Knowles dead at the end of 25, or incarcerated, or wasn't really clear whether he was dead or incarcerated at the time of the end of that issue, I think. I don't know if they had a leading him away in cuff scene or not. Not one that I can remember, at least. But I was saying at the time that I would prefer that they had left him and not brought him back. After reading the story where they did, what do you think, Kevin? Should they have brought him back? Was it worth it?
This is what you're going to do, then, I mean, it's all, I guess it's a strength of the creative team. It seems like there are fans of the story, and there are fans of a lot of Moon Knight stuff. There's even a scene in here where, like, a bunch of the creators are lit, like, written on the walls in the police station. But I don't know, like, sometimes that's a bad thing. Like, you're not going to the next thing. You're it's not exactly a greatest hits. Like, it's not that bad. Like, but yeah, I don't know. it's that weird line where, yeah, if this is just what you're gonna do, then
it will.
Well, it makes me wonder: are we to root for Moon Knight?
Right.
Like, is this where are we to enjoy him, like crippling just random?
That's just it.
Idiot thugs on the street. Like, we don't have the. I don't know. I feel they didn't lay the groundwork for that. If that's what we want, or if we're supposed to be grossed out by it. Well, it's hard. Like, he's the main character.
I couldn't even root for Marlene, and I always can root for Marlene.
Yeah. And so, when I thought
Frenchie was the only
Black
guy
Spectre
I was rooting
was
for.
Going to come and, like, save him from S.H.I.E.L.D., or they were going to do something else. I don't know. And then he was kind of like, oh, you feel the same way I feel. Everything's been taken away. And I'm like, but you didn't even do those things.
That's true. All right. What a crazy, crazy series. It wasn't until we would get skeleton beak suit wearing Khonshu that the character would get a breath of fresh air. And it would unfortunately be another decade after this. But
well, at least he usually has good art.
Thank goodness for that. He's a top five character of mine, guys, Moon Knight is. And it's frustrating that so many of his series is, especially around this time and shortly after, were so dark and not really enjoyable. Like I said, it's hard to be entertained when there's no one really to root for.
I like the art team.
Yeah, I was
See,
rooting for the
for
art
me,
team.
This,
True.
This,
Go Tex.
This Moon Knight, though, for me, is a little beefier than I think I would normally. I like him on the leaner side as an aesthetic choice. I just want to get your take. Like I said, I love the art team, but having him be that kind of bigger, heavier, almost like a Neil Adams Batman kind of solid dude. I don't know. I think I like the lean, athletic build better.
Yeah. Have you seen the Stephen Platt issues? Oy. And on that, we'll end this episode of Marvel Noise. Thanks for being here with us and walking the walk while we're talking the talk. Thanks, Kevin.
Good night,
thanks, Andrew. Good night. All right, until the alien Kotati and the interdimensional Hill 3 have tea together, make mine Marvel. Later.